You are listening to Aristogenesis, Episode 2, Part 1, The Hyperborean Myth, presented to you by NordiskRadio.se.
For this episode, we wanted to cover the Hyperboreans in both science and throughout myth and poetry, but we quickly realized that to do so in a single episode would be virtually impossible. The abundance of evidence and beautiful prose surrounding these enigmatic people would have resulted in hours upon hours of talking about the Hyperboreans. And so, instead, we decided to split the episode into two parts. This first part is helmed by Nesta, delving into the scientific evidence of our Hyperborean origins and looking into how an Indian scholar predicted the finds of modern science 100 years ago just by reading the Vedas. We'll also be talking about the links between the Hyperboreans and the Native Americans, as well as dispelling the out-of-Africa theory and exposing some modern political agendas within the scientific communities. We also have an account of the Nordic creation myth from Freyr to finish off with, as we don't want the episode to get too bogged down in scientific data and the discussion thereof. Next episode, led by myself, we'll be looking into the prevalence of the Hyperboreans throughout poetry and myth, as well as looking into the significance of the winter solstice as a festival throughout Indo-European cultures, and how all that correlates with Hyperborea. So stay tuned for that. We're also going to be publishing the script and further reading for this episode shortly, for those who want to read at their own pace and learn more. As always, we have to make the unfortunate disclaimer that promoting the love of your own people and delving into their true origins is not to be equated with the promotion of hatred for others. With all that said, let's begin.
In the previous episode of Aristogenesis, we presented an overview of the early Indo-Europeans, the early Aryans. We followed their migrations from their first well-documented areas of appearance at the steppes north of the Black and the Caspian Sea, about 4000 BC, into the whole of the European continent and to southwestern Asia. The coming of the Aryans was the most dramatic event in the history of the European continent, and has forever changed the anthropological landscape by redefining and reforming Europe into our Aryan fatherland. The conquest and transformation of Europe was gradual and continued through millennia as the different branches of the Aryan people came forth, developed their individual cultures by imposing the central, patriarchal, and upward to sky and light oriented features of their own character and tradition upon the earlier inhabitants, and thus evolving along more or less separate paths. The numerous Aryan tribes, seeds of the forthcoming nations and civilizations, sprang out and grew up as branches of the great oak of our race. And despite their accumulated differences and variations, they have always shared common fundamental characteristics and a uniquely distinct worldview, manifest in their religious attitudes, their mythology and cosmogony, and their philosophic contemplations. This remains only true as long as and at the extent that our peoples retain their basic racial purity and also remain true to themselves, as dictated as a central imperative by the tradition and the greatest Aryan sheikhs, from Heraclit, Pindar, and Apollo's central directive in Delphi, "Know thyself," where he slain the subterrestrial snake monster of the pre-Aryan chthonic cult, and from the eugenic laws of Manu in ancient India, down to the Neoplatonic esoteric teachings of Meister Eckhart or Scotus Erigena, and down to Goethe and Schiller. This essential authenticity and truthfulness to ourselves amounts to becoming conscious of and reaffirming our racial character, a character that derives from a common, vibrant, imperishable, and form-giving inner center, the eternal soul of our race. The awakening to that racial self-consciousness has been described as the second birth of an Aryan in the ancient tradition, and that was a prerequisite for somebody to be actually considered as an Aryan. One may be an Aryan by birth, but that is only a potential, which is only activated through an awakening to a higher, racially determined consciousness, so that one may be entitled to be an Aryan indeed, an active and conscious member of the race of the solar light, the Olympian race. During our podcast, we will look closer at the period between the early establishments and migrations of our ancestors, down to the emerging of the first Aryan civilizations at the dawn of history. Today, however, we wish to look further back in time and attempt to trace our ancestors before the archaeological spade undoubtedly detects them at the Pontic-Caspian steppes more than 6,000 years ago. As the time spans grow longer back into the Neolithic and Mesolithic ages, the archaeological evidence becomes scarce, and it is then normally very difficult to draw specific conclusions. The available scientific evidence indicates, however, that the Pontic-Caspian steppes were not the original homeland where our ancestors developed into a distinguished race, but a prolonged stopover, a base and a bridgehead that was established in the wake of a prior ongoing migration further back in time, with their first origin at another and very distant centrum. And the questions that naturally arise are: where did they come from? Which part of our planet can we call our ancient, immemorial homeland? Where is our true Urheimat? Our introductory hypothesis is that our ancestors' primordial home has been in the Arctic North, in a region situated high up in Arctic Siberia. We believe that our ancestors lived there for a long period prior to 10,000 BC, and most probably under more moderate climate conditions than the ones dominating over these areas nowadays. Evidence through very different sources suggests that it was major geophysical events that rendered the primordial fatherland uninhabitable, leading to the beginning of a migration southwards. Our Hyperborean conjecture has hitherto mainly been an intuition, well underpinned by and echoing ancient scriptures, traditions, and myths of our early ancestors, but in many cases even shining under locally and geographically unexplainable folkish survivals among Aryans living too far from the north. However, that inner certainty and reasonable hypothesis does now tend to be magnificently confirmed by firm scientific evidence and research of recent years. So, although we may by an accumulated speed keep talking about a hypothesis, it is only the more specific details and instances on which this term is justified, while there is no reasonable doubt anymore as to the existence of that remote Urheimat and the region where it was located. We will attempt today to summarize some of that evidence and to get a glimpse into the primeval Aryan literature, mythology, and traditions where the memory of an ancient Arctic fatherland is vivid and recurring. We shall also try to realize what kind of inner catalyst our primordial homeland must have been for shaping our ancestor psyche, albeit the physical and biological sides of that conditioning. We wish to explore how their most authentic existential contemplations and enduring traditions are firmly attuned to and reminiscent of the physical environment of that long forgotten and mythical place, even many thousands of years after it was abandoned. Let us briefly summarize the main points of that mentioned recent scientific evidence. In 2001, the archaeological spade unearthed some magnificent artifacts and tools in one of the northernmost regions of eastern Siberia and around Yana River, which have been dated to at least 30,000 years ago and which bear unequivocal evidence of the oldest high culture we have signs of. Meanwhile, the new fascinating science of archaeogenetics has developed, and thus in 2013, the genome and the Aryan identity of the famous Malta boy 24,000 years ago was identified, while further confirming that up to 30% of the ancestry of the American Indians comes from that proto-Aryan source. This last amazing assertion verifies the early premonitions of a prominent sage, Hermann Wirth. In his monumental work, The Dawn of Humanity, she could trace some solar eagle-like features on the culture, and even physically so, in particular on several leaders of the Indian. Even in that case, of such an exotic admixture, the typical pattern of an Aryan minority imposing its own spiritual character on a more or less alien majority and undertaking the leadership is verified. So luckily, archaeologists could find some human teeth in that mentioned very old settlement high up in northeastern Arctic Siberia around the mouth of Yana River, which have just last year been dated to have an age of 31,000 years, while scientists estimate that the communities had been there anyway at least as long as 40,000 years ago. Not at all surprisingly, for those of us who are able to discern deeply and effectively employ a higher intuition, the examination has also in this case testified their proto-Aryan identity. That is very crucial indeed, and a turning point as to what can be scientifically documented in our subject. Furthermore, it has through that analyzing of ancient DNA been possible to see that there were no signs of inbreeding, which suggests the presence of a considerable population divided into several related tribes. Pollen analysis has showed the presence of fauna associated with milder climate zones near the Arctic coast of Siberia, dating from late glacial times, 15 to 10,000 years BC, before these areas were claimed once more by tundra and permafrost due to the fluctuation of the ice sheets and major geophysical events. It is evident that the recurrence of the ice ages with dramatic changes in climate are important parameters in our hypothesis, and that is why we wish to make some clarifications. The ice ages are a quite recent phenomenon in the vast geological history of our planet. While many different theories have been presented by climatologists and geologists as to what triggered the onset of the great glaciations and which factors regulate their recurrence, the most predominant theories assign the onset of the ice ages to the Milankovitch cycles, which include periodic variations of the Earth's orbit around the Sun, the axial precession of the equinoxes, the inclination of the Earth's axis, and the wobble of its spin, altogether causing a severe fluctuation of the amount of heat the Earth receives from the Sun. Another theory suggests that the primary starting cause for the ice ages was the shifting of the poles from the open ocean of the North Atlantic and the South Pacific to their present locations in Arctic and Antarctica through the drifting of the Earth's crust upon the molten layers below millions of years ago. Such major geophysical and astronomical processes, as well as some more indirect factors such as the ocean currents, seem to have caused great fluctuations in temperature and climatic conditions, thereby also triggering ice ages. The size of the glaciers and the amount of water trapped in them do then dramatically affect the seawater level. As the glaciers grow or retreat, vast amounts of water are trapped or released, causing the seawater level to rise or sink, and subsequently great areas of land to go underwater or emerge. Geological surveys of the circumpolar regions have shown that the bed of the Arctic Ocean near the Eurasian shores is relatively shallow, and that during the last ice age, vast areas of land, from the shores of West Siberia all the way to the Bering Straits, were exposed and ice-free for thousands of years, before they were flooded again during the last retreat of the northern glaciers. The rise of the water levels in the oceans, which in some cases was dramatic and rapid enough to be remembered by the primordial man, may have given rise to the legend of the Great Flood that is encountered in the mythology of many peoples. The chronological and geographical fluctuation of patterns of the northern ice sheets over Europe and Siberia have been irregular, and accordingly, the climate has ranged from moderate to Arctic during the glacial and interglacial ages. A moderate climate could have tempted early humans to venture in the far northern regions, and later, as the geography, size, and location of the glaciers shifted, they may have found themselves trapped for thousands of years, surrounded by impermeable glacier masses and protected by mountain ridges and coastal dry belts. Such an isolated, remote scenery must have established some very special but quite stable conditions, fermenting the development of a very distinctly and sharply oriented culture and spirituality, along with an accordingly subtle and highly flexible language. The flatlands around the mouth of Yama River and Verkhoyansk mountain range of Siberia, where evidence of Aryan genome has been discovered, must have been that mythical landscape, the Aryan Urheimat. Comparative linguistics of the Indo-European languages is another major tool for the investigation of related matters. Linguists are able to actually reconstruct the early stage of Proto-Indo-European language before its differentiation into several branches. The common vocabulary reveals a lot about the culture, their environment, their social structure, and so on. Modern people often think of our prehistoric ancestors as primitive due to the indoctrinated belief of modern humanity in the childish hypothesis of continual progress, parallel to the modern spiritual degradation, which has rendered modern decadent man incapable of recognizing true cultural qualities and spiritual depth. Instead of that, he has created an illusionary and blindly materialistic equation between what he perceives as civilization and technical advancement, that is, the perfections of the tools, regardless the level and mode of existence and the qualities of the people themselves. This is really an inversion of values and essences, totally Marxist and Judaic in nature, which is only characteristic of the lowest stages of human development, during the darkest ages, and very typical of its essential imbecility. On the other hand, it is obvious that the available building materials in the Pontic-Caspian steppes 6 millennia or more ago, and especially in the circumpolar regions much earlier, cannot withstand time, as did the great marble and stone monuments the Aryans built in the south. Still, we have artifacts, including the famous Tokharian mummies of the Tarim Basin, 1,800 years BC, even from the Yana River, as mentioned. But we also have the famous Kurgans, that is, burial mounds, which to a great extent mark the course of the Aryans from the Pontic-Caspian steppes. Moreover, those Proto-Aryan communities have been on the move for thousands of years before they finally settled in the areas we find them in historical times. Migrating people do not build cities, temples, or monuments in a scale that may easily be detectable for archaeologists many thousands of years later. Our ancestors' language, however, tells another story. The elaborate structure of the ancient Indo-European languages, with their immense complexity and richness in grammatical and syntactical forms, capable of expressing the highest ideas with an abstraction endowed with the subtlest discernment and variation, accuracy and beauty. They bear an unequivocal evidence of the fact that our ancestors had reached a level of spiritual achievement which is not only unsurpassed ever since, but which is more or less unfathomable to the essentially dull and mediocre modern intellectuals. These phenomenally elaborate linguist faculties were analogous to the subtleness and complexity of their contemplations on all fields of thought of the highest quality, as well as to the ever unsurpassable poetic creations, of which we have an echoing in the earliest masterpieces in Sanskrit and in Greek, such as the Vedic hymns and the unparalleled Homeric poetry. The development of the Indo-European language indicates that some other specific preconditions must have been in place. All Indo-European languages derive from a common language spoken at the Pontic-Caspian steppes 6,000 years ago. At the time, this Proto-Indo-European language was already fully developed and entering a phase of differentiation into dialects and forms that would later become the basis of the Western and Eastern Indo-European language groups. The development of a truly distinct language, whose origins and structure cannot be closely associated to others, presupposes that a people has been living isolated from outer influences, cultural and linguistic, for a long time, many thousands of years. In the historical times, going back to at least 2000 BC, no new original languages have appeared, spoken or extinct, that cannot be associated with an already existing language family. The Proto-Indo-European language has already been formed in the 5th millennium BC, implying a very long period of growth and development prior to that. It's interesting to remark that in the historical period, the Indo-European languages have been undergoing an opposite process, that of simplification and deterioration, which cannot be but a sign of a total spiritual and intellectual devolution process, which is notably mentioned and predicted in our ancient scripts. The birth and growth of such an elaborate and refined language as the Indo-European may also require relatively stable conditions of existence, with time and resources for leisure and inner contemplation, which are unusual for migrating people, as our ancestors were long before they appeared at the Pontic-Caspian steppes. Some experts claim that the living conditions of the early hunter-gatherers or even the Neolithic farmers do not suffice either, as the daily and year-round effort for surviving with the available means, resources, and social structures of the time would not allow adequate leisure time for philosophical reflection and spiritual cultivation. We are, through the result, forced to assume that somehow such conditions must have been in place in our primordial Arctic fatherland, at least for the highest caste of the people. The means necessary for sustaining life must have been secured, as our ancestors dwelt in isolation for thousands of years in the magnificently dramatic and mystical environment of the Arctic homeland. As the archetypical structure of the Aryan societies was taking form, a caste of priests and scholars dedicated themselves to a spiritual and philosophical quest, developing rituals inspired by and centered around the most essential and dramatic event of the polar regions, the perennial disappearance and returning of life-giving sun. The solar and celestial character of the culture and inner experience of our ancestors has been their central distinctive feature. Their central deity was the Sky Father, incorporating their strictly patriarchal and combative spiritual and social constitution. This distinctive character and spirituality has then been carried by them from their ancient homeland to virtually every corner of the earth, and distinguished them sharply from the matriarchal and earthbound chthonic and telluric people and cultures they encountered as they spread out. Themes such as the arrival of the invigorating sun and the related principle of fire, the adoration of the sacred dawn, and so on, only understandable in the context of the remote homeland of their ancestors, is central in the most ancient Aryan literature, the hymns of Rig Veda from the Indo-Aryan Vedic tradition. In our endeavor to cast more light on the subject, we will look now for evidence about our primordial Arctic fatherland in ancient traditions, sacred scripts, Aryan mythology, and legends. As told in our first episode, we will not approach our myths as mere fairy tales, nor, of course, shall we grant them a naive scientific credit. Our myths are condensed ancient wisdom, appealing directly to and evoking a direct perception, which is usually completely unfathomable to the purely intellectual analysis. They consist of symbols, images, and allegories that can become shortcuts to inner inherent memory, induce rather than deduce recognition of basic or even of higher truths and eternal principles. As lively expressions of our racially determined archetypes and motives rooted in the depth of our soul by a mystical synthesis through our reawakened cognitive faculties, myths may then directly support and sustain our will, a will which is in a deep spiritual but also in a natural historic consideration recognizable as pertaining to blood, heritage, and race, and which has to be clarified and recognized as such and reunited in a harmonious collective racial expression if we are to survive and blossom once again by reversing the overhanging menace of our total racial degradation and extinction. We shall begin with the Indo-Aryan Vedas, a large collection of religious and philosophical texts accurately preserved as oral traditions through times immemorial until they were put to script in later historical times. The Vedas are an invaluable spiritual treasure and authentic and magnificent heritage from India's Aryan origins and the best preserved primordial heritage of the Aryans. The oldest part of the Vedas, the Rig Veda, was composed before the Aryan invasion of India 3,500 years ago. And it is a collection of splendid hymns and invocations that reflect a deep and rather direct perception of the cosmos, expressed in vivid poetic sensibility, genuine jewels of Aryan wisdom. in the dawn hymns of Rig Veda addressed to Ushas, the goddess of the dawn, we find descriptions of natural phenomena and astrological observations only visible in the polar regions. The hymns describe a dawn continuously lasting for many days, uninterrupted by sunlight, until it gave way to the rising sun. This magnificent phenomenon is exclusive for the circumpolar regions, where it can take many days, up to 2 months, between the first appearance of daylight after the long polar night and the rise of the sun. The Rig Vedic dawn was addressed in plural, not honorifically, but because it was made by many parts. The hymns speak of many dawns that appear one after another before the actual sunrise. Dawns that lived in the same place, acted harmoniously, and never quarreled with each other. The dawns were continuous and inseparable, forming a closely gathered band, or a group of dawns revolving round and round like a wheel, reaching the same goal, each dawn following its own destined course. The Rig Veda speaks also of 2 different couples of days and nights. The first one represents the ordinary days and nights, and the second is a distinct couple by itself, where one night and one day form the right and left side of the year, a clear suggestion of the polar night and the polar day. Furthermore, many expressions in Rig Veda denote the long journey of the sun, or the sun halting in the middle of the sky, hovering seemingly unmoved, as it actually appears to be during the long polar day, while it runs along a rather horizontal celestial circumference. They also speak of the long night and the long ghastly darkness in various forms, which sheltered the enemies of the sun god Indra, who had to fight the demons, the Dashas, who abode in it. This great anxiety that the long night might not end, the fear that the sunrise will not come, and the great anticipation for the dawn is central in Rig Veda. Thus, the cosmic event is, through the Aryan spirit, extended to the spiritual realm of the living cosmos, where it represents the perpetual fight between light and darkness, in which the fight for the light at one place or dimension magically affects the analogous fight everywhere in cosmos, ourselves and the inner realm included. The assignment of such a dramatic, esoteric significance to the perennial contest between day and night, light and darkness, sun and the agents of Erebos, could never arise naturally in the south, but only up in the highest holy Arctic north, where the advent of sun and light is crucial for the existence and survival of man. In the Rig Veda, the god Indra is said to uphold and separate by his power heaven and earth, like the 2 wheels of a chariot are held by the axle, turning the widest expanse like the wheels of a chariot. The motion of the heavens is described like that of a wheel, where stars and constellations remain on the same altitude, seemingly rotating around an axis, and where the constellation of Ursa Major lies always high, an exclusive feature of the heaven in the highest north. The idea of cosmic axis, like that of the cosmic tree, is an idea that permeates the Aryan tradition, and always with deep and dramatic, esoteric and metaphysical connotations. Just think of Yggdrasil. In the great Vedic epos of Mahabharata, we hear of Mount Meru, the lord of the mountains, the abode of all gods, and the terrestrial north pole of Hindu astronomy. As Arjuna, the central hero of the poem, whose name means white and clear, visits the mountain, we have a revealing description of it, unmistakably referring to its polar characteristics. At Meru, the sun and the moon go from left to right every day, and so do all the stars. The mountain, by its luster, overcomes the darkness of the night and can hardly be distinguished by day. The day and the night are together equal to a year for the residents of the place. The latter expression appears also in another Vedic text, the Laws of Manu. A human year is the day and the night of the gods. The two are divided. The northern passage of the sun is the day, and the southern is the night. The idea that day and night of the gods last each for 6 months, the description of the half-year-long night and day, is common throughout the whole Vedic literature, which, being very archaic, is written in a language even older than Sanskrit, and must clearly be related to the actual experience by the composers of the Vedas, or a surviving tradition of their ancestors, who did actually have that experience as their daily life. We do not wish to present here more details from the abundant evidence from Vedic literature that supports our thesis. We refer our listeners who may have a special interest on the subject to the works of the great Indian scholar B.J. Tilak, whose monumental work with its insightful interpretation of the Vedic text cover the topic in detail. Our next source is the Avesta, the authentic sacred scripts of the Iranian Aryans. The Avesta is a collection of religious and philosophical texts with roots dating back to the 2nd millennium BC. They are building up some fundamental theological and cosmological concepts that later became the foundations of the Zoroastrian religion. Besides their apparent linguistic proximity, many aspects and the essential spirit of the Zoroastrian theology and worldview are very similar to those of the Vedas, indicating a common primordial religious system from the time before the divergence of the Indo-Aryans into separate groups. The Avesta, just like the Vedas, reflects the profound philosophical understanding and theological insight the early Aryans had. Despite the occasional foreign influences, compromises, and corruptions that occurred during thousands of years of religious practice and contact with Oriental peoples and cultures, they are still a great and authentic source of information regarding our ancestors' perception of the cosmos. Quite like the Vedas, the Avestan books contain many passages indicated that the Iranian Aryans were well aware of the polar day and night lasting 6 months each. There is a passage, however, in the first two chapters of the Avestan book of Vendidad, which directly refers to the ancient home far to the north and to the causes that forced the Aryans to abandon it and migrate southwards. In this chapter, Ahura Mazda, the wise lord, the supreme creator and sustainer of cosmos, explains to Zarathustra how he created the original 16 lands of the Aryans, and how all of them were subsequently undermined and destroyed by Angra-Mainyu, also known as Ahriman, the destructive and disorderly spirit incorporating what Savitri Devi describes as the powers of active death, the chaotic opponent to the forces of cosmic order in this beautiful Zoroastrian conception. He explains how Aryanaveyu, the cradle and birthplace of the Aryans, as the name signifies, The first and most blissful creation of Ahura Mazda was invaded by severe winter and snow and converted into an ice-bound land where harsh winter dominated for 10 months and the summer only lasted for 2. In the same chapter, Ahura Mazda warns Yima, the great mythological progenitor of the Iranian people, of the fatal winters that are about to fall upon his lands, and how he should prepare for them in order to survive. The verses are capturing. And Ahura Mazda spoke unto Yima, saying, O fair Yima, son of Vinganat, upon the material world the fatal winters are going to fall, that shall bring the fierce foul frost. Upon the material world the fatal winters are going to fall, that shall make snowflakes fall thick, deep on the highest tops of mountains. And all the three sorts of beasts shall perish, those that live in the wilderness, and those that live on the tops of the mountains, and those that live in the bosom of the dale, under the shelter of stables. Yima is advised to build a vara, an enclosure, and place animals and seeds to escape the harsh winter. The shelter is prepared, and Yima asks Ahura Mazda, O maker of the material world, thou holy one, what lights are there to give light in the vara which Yima made? Ahura Mazda answered, There are uncreated lights and created lights. There the stars, the moon, and the sun are only once a year seen to rise and set, and a year seems only as a day. These Avestan scripts describe conditions only observable in the far north, and the story does obviously correspond to the myth of the great cataclysm, where the supreme god warns and saves the mythological forefather, such as Defkalion in Hellas, Manu in India, and so on, from the oncoming flood. The myth is Aryan in origin, and the Avestan legends speak of a deluge made not of water and rain, but of snow and ice, providing thus a different perspective as to the scenery of the deluge and the origin of our people. They speak also of a primordial land with moderate and pleasant climate, Ahura Mazda's most wonderful creation, before it was engulfed in ice and frost. The memory of this land survived, often romanticized, in the historical times, and the Aryan descendants of the Hellenic and Roman antiquity called it Hyperborea, the land beyond the northern wind. In Hellas, the god of light, music and harmony was the Hyperborean Apollo, and his priestesses at the holy island of Delos were the Hyperborean virgins. By that time, it was already a legend and an enigma, a vague remembrance that excited the curiosity of historians and inspired the poets. But that will be the subject of our next episode. Up to this point, we have been looking for concrete evidence in our ancient traditions. By no means, however, is it our intention to diminish and simplify our myths into vague historical hints, or rationalize them into dry scientific data devoid of higher content. Our myths are a legacy inseparably integrated with our traditions, and our traditions become folklore and customs that put us in touch as we practice them with that same mythical, timeless source of genuine essence and life that gave birth to our myths. In our people's psyche, winter and summer solstices still bear elements of that mystical cosmic essence and Aryan spirituality, even at an unconscious level. This dramatic astrophysical phenomenon has had central importance for our ancestors, and it was celebrated with religious rituals and festivities throughout the ancient Aryan world. It demonstrates our northern origin, as it is only there our primordial ancestors could observe, receive, and interpret the solstice as a decisive cosmic event with actual impact on and significance in their lives. Only in the circumpolar regions can one behold the solar circles in their full scale and magnificence, which inspired our ancestors to partake in the sun's eternal struggle against the long polar darkness, and recognize the cosmic analogy and the counterpart of this struggle within ourselves and in our societies too. The tradition of the solstice has been so strong that it never was broken or lost, not even as new foreign religions replaced the old tradition. The winter solstice was replaced by Christmas, and the summer solstice by the day of St. John the Baptist. These superficial disguises fail, however, to conceal the genuine cosmical meaning and the profound metaphysical depth of the solstices. As our people today light bonfires and celebrate the rebirth of the invincible sun, they do unconsciously participate in the primordial Hyperborean tradition and vigilantly preserve its ancient memory, as they subconsciously join the perennial struggle of the solar forces to reclaim the world from disorder, confusion, and decay. The reference to that primordial Arctic origin becomes even more unequivocal and definite when such solstice bonfires are lit in the south, as for example, many villages in Greece still keep it as a holy tradition they received from the forefathers, simple, illiterate people for whom life and tradition cannot prosper apart, for whom the retainment of such traditions is just self-evident. We shall have succeeded to our target with these podcasts if we contribute to raise such an unconscious up to the light of a new vigilant Aryan consciousness and will.
And now we move into the discussion part of the episode. I'm here with Nesta. How are you doing?
I'm great, thank you.
Great. Well, your monologue was mainly focused on the scientific evidence for the Aryan origin in the polar north. And one of the sources you mentioned was the Indian scholar Tilak. And I thought that it was very interesting that a lot of this came from an Indian scholar, because a lot of Indian nationalists now refuse to believe in an Aryan migration of almost any kind. A lot of them say that the idea of an Aryan invasion is a conspiracy theory made up by colonial powers. So I think it's very interesting that one of the founders of this idea, one of the first scholars to really talk about it, was himself Indian.
Yes, absolutely. I'm using a lot of information from the Indian scholar Tilak's book that was published in 1904, quite a long time ago. And it's very interesting because Tilak was the first one to present this hypothesis in the modern times, that the primordial fatherland of the Aryans were somewhere in the Arctic North. And he was also the first one to be quite curious when he was reading and understanding the myths and the legends and the Vedic literature. He realized that what he's reading there may not just be myths and legends, but he suspected there's some actual truth in this. Now, let me start from the beginning. Tilak was an Indian scholar, an expert on Vedic literature and the Sanskrit language. That's very important. One cannot underestimate how important this is, because not only was he an expert in the content of the Vedic literature, being an expert in the language, he can actually interpret context from the original text in the depth and the accuracy that's necessary. So he proposed this hypothesis that the primordial Aryan fatherland lies somewhere in the Arctic North, based upon descriptions of the locations of constellations, of astrophysical phenomena and descriptions of climate conditions that only exist in the circumpolar regions. And he proposed the Hyperborean hypothesis for the first time, 1904. She was also very curious in the European mythology, so she actually investigated and searched sources there. So in his book, there are chapters regarding the Celtic mythology, the Hellenic mythology, the Roman mythology, that are very useful. And we'll be talking about this a little bit more on our next episode.
Yes, definitely. I just wanted to say that because it was obviously written in 1904, that was still during the colonial era, but it was before it started to become controversial to talk about this idea of an Aryan invasion or an Aryan origin anywhere. That idea became very controversial, obviously, after the Second World War, but now it's starting to come out that, yeah, it was right all along.
Absolutely. Tillack was very confident. He knew that at his time, the scientific evidence was lacking to prove his hypothesis. But he was very confident that science will prove him right, and it did. And when we say science at his time, he meant mostly geology and geophysics. And he was, but we must understand the time he was writing, 1904. That was even before the time of the great polar explorations that culminated about 10 years later, where the great polar explorers from Norway and Sweden and America and Great Britain venture up to the north and make this amazing heroic task and these heroic expeditions where they actually went all the way to the north and the south pole. My point is, at the time when Tillack was writing, the people knew almost nothing about the poles. They actually knew much more about the surface of the moon than they knew about the north and the south pole. Tillack was confident that his hypothesis that the primordial fatherland of the Aryans was somewhere in the Arctic North will be proven right by science, as it did in the 20th century. And what he meant was that those areas, the circumpolar areas, were a long time ago ice-free and habitable and with a much more moderate climate. And as I said, modern science has proved him right in the 20th century all the way through. Now we know for sure that during the last ice age, vast amounts of lands in northeast Siberia were not covered with ice. They were ice-free. That's a fact. Pollen analysis has also showed that in those areas there was fauna and vegetation associated to moderate climates. We also know from archaeological research that there were people living there. We have found remnants and artifacts. And of course, we also know that the shores of the northeast Siberia were much wider, and vast amounts of lands actually were over the waterline as the water retreated and as the ice sheets expanded. And these land masses from the northeast Siberia all the way to the Bering Straits that were not covered with water, that were elevated over the water as the waterline receded. They even have their own name. It's called the Beringian Continent.
So you spoke about Tillack and his look into mythology and his look into the Vedas and his belief that science would validate his hypothesis. I understand that there's quite a lot of DNA evidence that you're wanting to talk about as well.
Absolutely. This is actually the most interesting information we have to present to our listeners in this episode. And I explained a little bit more in the text. But as we say, the whole idea of the Aryan primordial fatherland up in the north has been a hypothesis, an enigma since the times of antiquity. And now for the first time, we have DNA evidence that showed that the Proto-Aryans were actually there. I mentioned the Malta boy. Now, we're talking about the remnants of a boy that were discovered north of Lake Baikal in south-central Siberia. And they date from 24,000 years ago. And the genetical code was only read in 2013. So this is new evidence. Now, this boy DNA matches that of Western Europeans, living Western Europeans, and shows that during the last ice age, people from Europe had reached further east across Eurasia. Now, for the first time, we actually find them there. And even more interesting is actually the findings discovered in Yana River, in the delta of Yana River, up in the Arctic northeastern Siberian coast, that also date from 31,000 years ago. Now, up there, there's an excavation site. And you must understand, what does it mean to have an excavation site up there? Siberia is enormous. I mean, parts of Siberia have the size of a continental Europe. The climate is harsh. The place is inhospitable and very difficult to approach. And regardless, there are archaeologists searching. And not only they found in the delta of the Yana River up in Siberia artifacts and tools and remnants indicating, first of all, that people have ventured and survived up there, but they also find, luckily enough, two baby teeth, two milk teeth, that have enough and solid DNA evidence to give us a whole different perspective. Now, that DNA that was of good quality and was decoded shows was related to the Western Eurasian hunter-gatherers. And for the first time, we have solid evidence of the Aryan presence in those areas. I cannot emphasize enough the importance of these findings in the Yana Site River. For the first time in history, we have clear proof of the Proto-Aryan presence in these areas. Now imagine, this hypothesis has been a subject of discussion for decades. And nobody was sure. Everything was pointing to that direction. And those who could understand the legends, history and archaeology better, had this intuition that it must be there. It must be this location. People who could actually read the maps and understand the geology and the morphology of the area were more or less pointing in that area. And now for the first time, within these two milk teeth, we found the Proto-Aryan DNA. Moreover, the analysis of the DNA material from this milk teeth found in the site of the Yana River shows something else that's very fascinating. It shows that there were no signs of interbreeding. What does it mean? It means that these children, whose milk teeth belonged to, they were living in groups as big as up to 500 individuals. In many groups as big as 500 individuals. This indicates a large network of hunter-gatherers, large populations. So they were not individuals, solitude individuals, that found themselves there by mere chance. There was an established large population.
Well, it's fascinating that we have actual DNA evidence now to show that our ancient ancestors were there in Siberia rather than just having to, you know, rely on myth. But I think as well, it's equally fascinating that just from looking into these myths, someone like Tillack could accurately guess the conclusion of science over 100 years later. So, you know, maybe there's a lot more truth to some of these myths than we might think. But I believe you're wanting to talk about the link this has, especially with Siberia, to the Native American populations, especially in North America.
Absolutely. The analysis of the DNA extracted from the Malta boy and from the milk teeth in the Yana River offered one more fascinating surprise and shed light to the matter of the ancestry of the Native American Indians and confirmed what many scholars and many of us have suspected all along. Up to 30% of the American Indians' genetic origin comes from these ancient North Eurasians. About a third of Native American ancestry came from these Proto-Aryans, the rest being, of course, Asiatic and Mongolic, which obviously dominate their phenotypes as well. What happened? About 20,000 years ago, these Proto-Aryans intermingled with in Siberia with the Asiatic, racially Asiatic, not only geographically Asiatic groups. And the groups that came forth were the ancestors of the Native Americans who reached the Americas via the Bering Straits, the Beringian continent. To begin with, this conclusively confirms the theory that the American Indians came to North America via the Bering Straits, as we find now their genetic trace on either side of the straits. But now think, how many suspicions we have and how many hypotheses are circulating about the until now unexplainable relation between ancient civilizations in North and Mesoamerica and the Aryans. All these symbols, the architecture, the religiosity we find in the Americas that seem to be so similar to the Aryan. Now we know why. I mentioned in my reading earlier the great scholar Hermann Wirth, who already for 100 years ago in his book Der Aufgang der Menschheit, The Dawn of Humanity, he wrote that the Indian American traditions have an Aryan, solar-like essence. And that's true, they do. She even wrote that many leaders of Indian American tribes even had physical Aryan characteristics. She saw in these American Indian tribe leaders something regal, warlike, and noble that was familiar to him and characteristic of the Aryans, but only in the leaders. The old repeating history of the Aryan race becoming the highest and leading case of the people they encountered when they were outnumbered. Well, regarding the Native American people and culture, now, for the first time, we have scientific evidence of their suspected and now proven relationship to the Aryans.
See, that's interesting that you've brought up the Mesoamerican cultures, because a lot of people associate, especially the Aztecs, with South America. But if you read the Aztecs' history of themselves, they say that they started very far up north and they migrated down south at the order of the gods. And it's very interesting because the god that they said ordered them to migrate southwards was Huitzilopochtli, the Aztec god of war. And when Cortez arrived by boat, they believed that he was the return of Huitzilopochtli. They believed that he and the Spanish sailors with them, because their skin was like lime, and it was this idea of these men with pale skin had come by boat, and this was the return of the gods that had originally told them to migrate in the first place. But the Aztecs themselves actually inherited a lot of their culture from the Toltecs, and I believe there's quite a bit about the Toltecs and their capital city that you wanted to talk about.
Yes, absolutely. To begin with, the Toltec capital was called Tula, and their culture, Tolan. Now, both Tulan, Tolan, and the name Toltec itself is etymologically related to Tule, the mythical land in the north, often associated to Hyperborea itself. They were ferocious warriors. They had a cyclical view of time, like other related Mesoamerican cultures. They were also sun worshippers. They built what we call the celestial architecture, where their magnificent pyramids and monuments were aligned to constellations and astrophysical phenomena, an architectural principle common to the Aryans. I would like, however, to talk about a Native American tribe that was related to the Toltecs and caught my attention. They were called the Tula, again, the Tula people, and lived in what is today Arkansas in USA. Now, these are very interesting American Indians. We have a glimpse of them in history by the records of a famous conquistador, Hernando de Soto. De Soto was an extremely skilled conquistador and planned Pizarro's conquest of the Inca Empire. De Soto was also the first conquistador to venture in North America, north of the Mississippi River, and there he met the Tula tribe. He fought them in many bloody wars in 1541, I think. And in records of those battles, the Tula people were described as the best fighting people that the Christians met with. Now, this praise, coming from a war veteran like De Soto, who fought countless tribes, should not be taken lightly. The Tula people were described also as sun worshippers, and they were building pyramid-like monuments. Now, not a long time ago, I accidentally came upon and watched a documentary on television about the now living descendants of the Tula people in Arkansas. They are very careful in preserving their traditions. In the documentary, they went to their pyramid-like monument made of earth to celebrate the summer, I think, solstice. And there, they were dancing beautiful, traditional, circular dances. Circular dances are fundamentally Aryan. The dancers hold each other's hands, forming a circle, and dance around in beautifully orchestrated and harmonious steps without moving their hips and mostly working with their legs. I'm sure many listeners have seen how the usual traditional Indian American folk dances look. They are not circular. Circular dances are found either among Aryans or indicate Aryan influence. And these dances are still today danced all over Europe and especially in Hellas. But there are other theories also regarding the Americas and the Aryan origins. For example, Julius Evola, the famous mystic and philosopher, was also very interested in the Hyperborean myth and wrote a lot in his works about the Arctic origin of the Proto-Aryans, mostly using evidence from comparative mythology. And we shall put his books and articles that are relevant to the subject and our episode in our further reading section. Now, Evola believed that besides the southwards migration of the early Aryans from the Arctic to Europe and Asia, there was another one, much older migration, that he associated to the sudden appearance of the megalithic civilization in Europe. This Paleolithic culture that is called megalithic has left behind impressive stone monuments all over, from the Scandinavian peninsula to the north, all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. Now, these monuments are stones aligned in rows or spirals, as we see in the north, huge menhirs or dolmens, stone circles or gigantic stone walls in South Europe, called the Cyclopean Walls. This earlier migration to Europe is known as the Atlantean one, because the monuments we recognize it from appeared first at the Atlantic coast of Europe, in the Iberian Peninsula, in North and West France, and in the British Islands, and there, from West Europe, spread through the whole continent. Evola claims that the creators of this megalithic civilization were an early form of Europeans, an early form of European Homo sapiens, the famous Cro-Magnon people, who were also the creators of the earliest prehistoric cave paintings in Europe, as for example in France, paintings whose artistic quality is unique. And by the way, the Cro-Magnon people had a slightly larger brain capacity from modern Europeans. So the megalithic civilization suddenly appears in the Atlantic coast of Western Europe and then spreads in the continent, suddenly, of course, in archaeological time frames. One must always be curious when civilizations suddenly appear, because it is unusual. Civilizations grow and develop, and signs of this growth are usually also found. Evola's theory is that the creators of this civilization came across the sea. They crossed the Atlantic from America, either directly or through an intermediate center, which Evola thinks was a famous mythical submerged continent of Atlantis, from where they spread to Europe, to the south shores of the Mediterranean, and South America, and eventually giving rise to the Egyptian civilization that also suddenly appeared, and the Mesoamerican civilization, both famous for building pyramids. Now, the theory of the submerged continent of the Atlantis is not yet, at least, scientifically proven, but we should not take it lightly. As we know now, land masses have risen from the oceans or submerged under them countless times in our planet's geological history. And furthermore, the famous Greek philosopher Plato describes in his works and in details the Atlantis, using information and traditions that came to him by Egyptian priests. And when a man with the status of Plato speaks about it, we should at least give it some consideration. This Western migration to Europe took place much, much earlier than the southward migration of the Proto-Aryans from the north, and possibly again from the Arctic to the Americas and then to Europe, with or without the Atlantis, and much earlier than the crossing of the Bering Straits from the ancestors of the Native Americans. These ancestors of the Native Americans who very possibly found descendants of those Aryans of the first migration in the Americas, as the Kennewick men I mentioned earlier seems to be. This theory awaits its scientific proof, but all evidence points to that direction, and the Siberian DNA I talked about earlier grants this Western migration hypothesis even more credibility.
Well, we've spoken quite a lot about this idea of a northern origin point and the north being the sort of birthplace of our people, but that must be ringing a few alarm bells in a few people's heads, a few people listening, because they're going to be thinking, well, don't we all come from Africa? And the answer to that is no. The out of Africa theory is complete nonsense. And I'd just like to talk about that for a minute, because it was debunked almost 13 years ago. And that's at the very latest. There's an article published on the 8th of August 2007 in the Scientific American, and it speaks about a selection of over 5,000 teeth. And that's interesting because it was also milk teeth that identified these ancient North Eurasians in Siberia. But again, it's teeth. They were examined and found to cast real serious doubt on the out of Africa theory. The teeth were from what we would call in layman's terms the Ice Age. The study says they're from the Pleistocene period, but that's extremely broad. The Pleistocene is anywhere between 11,700 and 2,500,000 years ago. So it's a huge, huge range. The study was conducted by the National Research Center on Human Evolution in Spain, and without wanting to read the whole article verbatim, we'll put the article in the further reading. The article, it says, the continuity of the Eurasian dental pattern from the early Pleistocene period, early Pleistocene meaning 2,500,000 years ago, until the appearance of Upper Pleistocene Neanderthals, suggests that the evolutionary courses of the Eurasian and African continents were relatively independent for a long period. So, 2,500,000 years ago, there were already genetically distinct Europeans who had not come from Africa, who obviously we wouldn't recognise as Europeans if they were walking down the street, but they still left enough of a DNA legacy to be traced back as the ancestors of modern contemporary Europeans. So just put that timeline into perspective, because I really cannot stress enough how far back this is. The city of Rome was founded in 2,773 years ago. Aryans first appeared in ancient Greece, we believe, 3,520 years ago. And Proto-Indo-Europeans started forming their language. That language is 6,520 years old. These distinct European teeth are 2,500,000 years old. The implications of that kind of discovery, that just can't be overstated, but this article is almost 13 years old, and most people are still clinging to the out of Africa theory anyway, despite this information being freely available, because it contradicts the media's narrative of one race, the human race. The idea that, I mean, the fact that this theory is still held as true by the general population is proof of the media's ability to so easily shape the racial consciousness, essentially being politically correct in their very approach to genetical science. This is something that they freely admit. For example, this evidence of Europeans and Africans having evolved separately, it contradicts this politically correct narrative. So with all this evidence coming to light, these kind of tactics that they're using, which has previously been to suggest that we're all from one root and therefore there's no difference between us, that is being questioned. So what they're now doing is portraying ancient Europeans as much like foreigners as possible. Take Cheddar Man, the infamous example. His skin tone, it's still unknown to this day, because they didn't find the allele to say that he was pale white-skinned, so they assumed that he was darker-skinned than the average European now. But that was taken, and they made him as dark as possible to us, to the average person, for seemingly no reason. But obviously there is an agenda behind it. British media portraying him as a black man. He wasn't sub-Saharan African. There's also the White Hawk woman, who was depicted as looking like a modern Middle Easterner. Both of those two facial reconstructions were made by the helping hands of a guy called Tom Booth. And he's a man who openly admits to using his work to, quote-unquote, fight white nationalism. So whether you agree with his agenda or not, there's no question that an agenda is clearly in play, and these facial reconstructions are created with his agenda in mind. So we'll have a link to his article along with the other articles that we've mentioned. We'll publish that in the further reading section. His article is called "Response to Brexit, Archaeology and Heritage, Reflections and Agendas." So you can probably guess where it's going with that.
That marks the end of this episode, and as promised, we have Freya reading into the Nordic creation myth, a topic I'm sure we will give a broader overview of in the future. In our next episode, we're going to be sticking with the Hyperboreans and seeing how they appear in mythology, as well as the traditions with which they were credited as being the founders. In the meantime, you can subscribe to our YouTube channel, though we're not sure how long that's going to stay up. It's also called Aristogenesis, and we upload these podcasts a little bit later with some fancy graphics and the like. You can also follow us on Instagram, if you're on there, at aristogenesis.ig. But for now, you've been listening to Aristogenesis on nordiskradio.se, and we hope you enjoy Freya's account of the Nordic creation myth. Until next time.
In Norse cosmology, there are nine worlds. The Vala, also called the Vulva, she spoke and she remembered. The world of the gods, the world of light and dark elves, the world of the giants and the dwarves, the world of mankind, and the realm of fire and ice. She remembered the great measuring tree, the world tree, Yggdrasil, in the midst of all these worlds. She remembered giants of old, Jötnar, who nurtured and raised her before the nine worlds. I will speak on the creation saga in Norse myth. In the beginning, the heat melted the ice in the Nordic land. There was the land of Niflheim in the north, icy and cold, also called the Misty World, den dim höljda världen, the land of death. And there was Muspelheim in the south, a world of heat and fire, also called Världsbranden. Between the world of Niflheim and Muspelheim is Ginnungagap, the gaping abyss, the vid öppna gapet, the primordial yawning void. And the warm flames of Muspelheim started to melt the ice wall on the other side of the gap, and the drops that fell into Ginnungagap created the ur-giant Jötun Ymer. Out of Rimfrost came the primordial cow Audumbla, where Ymer got his nourishment from drinking the cow's milk, and the cow got nourishment from licking the salt from a stone. Out of Ymer's leg grew the first giant, Rimtursen Trutjelmer. He had three heads and gave birth, without a father and a mother, to Rimtursen Beljelmer. The male and female emerged from Ymer's left forearm. The first humans, Ask and Emla, were born. And the Vala spoke in her prophecy in Völuspá. Of old was the age when Ymer lived. Earth had not been, nor heaven above, but a yawning gap and grass nowhere. Two, without fate, on the land they found, Ask and Embla, empty of might. Soul gave Odin, sense gave Hörner, heat gave Lodur, and godly hue. The elder Edda talks about the three creation gods, Odin, Hörner, and Lodur, and how they gave life to the first humans. Odin gave them breath or soul, Hörner gave them sense or understanding, and Lodur gave them heat or the blood of life and godly color. Before we go any further with Norse creation story, let's look a little bit closer. Who were these three creation gods? Odin we already know a lot about, but who was Hörner and Lodur? Hörner, he's the only god of the three that will survive Ragnarök. There were two groups of gods, the Æsir and the Vanir, and at one point they were at war with each other. And at the peace treaty, the Vanirs were given a ransom by the Æsir, and that was Hörner. And the Vanir made him their new leader. They called him the Fast Æsir, den snabbe Asen. And according to old Germanic folklore, Hörner is the god behind the stork, who delivers the newborn child. And etymologically, Hörner is Old Germanic for Hehunjas, meaning stork. Another etymological connection is the Greek word Huhinjas, meaning swan. So Hörner is considered to be the swan-like god. There are other Indo-European similar stories about swans. Who is Lodur? Lodur had sworn brotherhood with Odin. It's called Fostbrödralag. Let me just quickly explain what that is. It's foster brotherhood. It's a long life friendship that unites two warriors. This is stronger than even being blood brothers. A ritual will bind the brothers together through mixing of their blood. Put on a turf of grass that was put on a spear, and then given an oath and promise before the gods to avenge one another, then mingle the turf of grass onto the ground again. This custom is believed to have been an ancient Germanic ritual, and there are similar customs like that mentioned by the Greek Herodotus around 484 before Christ. So Loder and Odin were very close, and they mixed their blood. In Iceland, there was a Christian monk called Snorri Sturlason. He was an author. He was also a lawman, a politician, and a historian, living around 1100, beginning of 1200 AD. Before Snorri, there was very little documentation of the Norse sagas. The sagas and the lores were traditionally passed from generation to generation orally. But for some reason, Snorri Sturlason removed both Loder and Hörner from the creation saga and exchanged them with Vile and Ve. But since Snorri removed the gods from its rightful place in the creation myth, it's time to put them back. From a Christian perspective, it could be a bit controversial for me to then reveal to you that this god Loder is Loke, and he's also called Hagal. Loke being the most misunderstood of the pantheon gods in Norse myth. He was erratic and incalculable, connected to fire, and he was also called the fire god and the lightning god. Connected to witches, he bestowed a double nature. Loki both created chaos, but he also created restoration, replacing chaos with order. He brought calamity on the gods, but he also brought them prosperity and happiness, equipping them with power tools to fight and conquer. For example, Thor was given Mjölnir by Loki, and the eight-legged horse Sleipnir is birthed and given to Odin by Loki. And the sword of Tyr was also given by Loki. And there are many more examples of how Loki sustained the gods with solutions. So one could say that both Odin and Loder, which is Loki, could be considered to be universal gods. Creators, sustainers, and destroyers. Let me compare with the universal God from the Bible, Isaiah 45, which says, I am the Lord, and there is none else. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and I create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. So the God in the Bible also created evil for a purpose. Chaos and restoration goes hand in hand with the universal gods. We see this in many other myths as well. The gods that were important to the people in Scandinavia, they formed cults around these gods. We know that there have been a Frey and a Freya cult, as well as an Odin cult. But never have there been a Loki cult, at least not that we know of. But we do know that there have been a Hagal cult, especially in southern Sweden, in Skåne, and in the west coast of Sweden. They gave offerings to their god Hagal in the hawthorn groves. And remember, Hagal is Loki. The hawthorn tree, by the way, grows very old and have branches with sharp thorns. And the flower is quite interesting as well. I will talk about this and other cults in Sweden or Scandinavia during the Vendel and Viking era time in another episode. So now let's go back to the Norse creation story. The brothers Odin, Hörner, and Loder grew up and became big and strong, and together they decided to kill the giant Ymir. They succeeded, and the blood from the giant poured forth and drowned all the other giants in the land, except for Bergelmer and his family. The brothers then carried Ymir's body to the center of Ginnungagap and created the world out of him. From his flesh, the earth was built. The mountains were made out of his bones, and the blood of the giant was turned into oceans and rivers. Teeth and jaws became boulders and stones, and the firmament of the sky was shaped from Ymir's skull, and from the brain the clouds were created. The sparks that came out of Muspelheim became the stars in the sky, and the dead worms of Ymir's flesh became the dwarves, and the four dwarves were placed in each corner of the earth, and they were called Östre and Västre, Nordre and Södre. They shall uphold the skull of Ymir, the firmament of the sky, Himlavalvet, so that it will stay in place. When we do have blues here in Scandinavia, we open and close our ceremonies by pointing to all four directions, recognizing the dwarves for upholding the four corners of the earth. The Norns, Verdandi, Skuld and Urd, sitting under the world tree Yggdrasil, weaving the destiny of the life thread of humans, also came from the giant Ymir. I have a little poem. Goes like this. With bountiful wisdom the maidens sit under the tree of Yggdrasil. Urds hold the fate of human folk, Verdandi the knowledge of now. Skuld is the third with future in mind. The thread of men and gods are twined. A little poem by me. Okay, we go on. Odin and Hörner and Loder, let the people live in Midgård, protected by the ring wall made by Ymir's eyebrows. So then the creation gods put also the sun and the moon and night and day on their horses to ride around the earth of Mundilfari, which means the father in the sky, the one moving according to particular times. The day in Old Norse is Dagr and is personified as the son of Delinger and is associated with the bright horse Skinfaxi, who draws day to mankind. Dagr is described as bright and beautiful as his father's people, and his father Delinger, meaning the dawn, Grunningen, is also called Delling's door, representing the runa Dagas, number 23 in the Hötarken. The polarity to Dagr is not the night. Nott is described as black and swarthy. She is personified as the grandmother of Thor. And Dagr and Nott rides their horse chariots around the earth every 24 hours. Nott rides before Dagr, and the foam from her horse, Hrimfaxi's bit, sprinkles the earth with the dew. In the poetic Edda, the Valkyries Sigdrifa, when given the mead of memory, was speaking a poem about Nott and Dagr. It goes like this. Hail to the day, hail to the sons of day, to night and her daughters hail. With placid eyes behold us here, and here sitting give us victory. Hail to the Aesir, hail to the Asunir, hail to the bounteous earth. Words and wisdom give us noble twain and healing hands while we live. The sun is the goddess Sol, or Sunna in Old Norse, and her brother Mani, the moon, must pass through Mundilfari every day and night to count the years for man. The sun goddess with her sun chariot, Solvagnen, and two horses is called Alfrudul. It means she lights up the worlds. But also she's being pursued by the wolf Skull, who eventually will devour her. The sun goddess gave birth to a daughter, and she will take the goddess' place at the time of Ragnarök, when Sol is eaten by the wolf. The myth of the goddess Sol pulling her sun chariot could be from Nordic Bronze Age with Proto-Indo-European roots, and Sol with her chariots is also an elf beam, a human-like supernatural being that shines with magical powers. And the word elf is found throughout the Germanic languages and have originally meant white being. Mani in Old Norse is the moon, and he's the brother of Sol and the son of Mundilfari, the one moving according to particular times. And he will also be destroyed in Ragnarök as part of the creation cycle of cosmos. It's the wolf Mannagram, the moon hound, the moon dog, the son of Fenrir, who will swallow this heavenly body, the moon. Before the new era, where Sol's daughter at the new dawn shall appear on her horse Glær, there will be the apocalyptic event of Ragnarök, the destruction of old governmental reign, where the last fate of mythological gods like Odin, Thor, Frey, Heimdall and Loki shall all die in a flood that puts the world under water. And the giants shall set the world, or the worlds, on fire before it sinks to the bottom of the ocean. And the world and everything in it shall then return to the darkness of Ginnungagap, the magical abyss. The vulva sees the earth ascends again from the sea, with green and ready to harvest fields. In perfect condition it ascends from the magical abyss, and a new era will be imminent, and that will be led by Balder, the broadly shining one, den vida omkring glänsande. And the surviving Aesir shall meet again at the field of Idavulr, the meeting place of the gods. They will meet in Gimle, that is the new Midgård, and they will talk about the terrible girdle of the earth, Jordens Jördel, the Midgård serpent, Jormungandre. They are all being reminded of the mighty past and the ancient runes that rules the gods. The surviving gods are the two sons of Thor and the three sons of Odin and most of the Asynir. Leif and Livstrasil, which means the one who clings to life, de seglivade, they start life again after they survived Ragnarök. And these two people shall repopulate the world. They are the grandparents of the coming age. But evil is still among them. Nidhugg, the dragon who gnaws on the roots of Yggdrasil, is still alive. And in the new era, when Balder and Höder will reign, Nidhugg shall be seen in the distance. His feathers are filled with the corpse as the dusky dragon sweeps across the plain. It is clear that this new world will also go down, and the children of the gods will meet their Ragnarök. But just like the wheel of the year, Julåret, around December 22nd, when we celebrate Jule, starts all over again, so the cosmic wheel shall start again for the gods and folks to grow into deeper understanding. Again shall the heat from the fire of Muspelheim melt the cold and icy land of Niflheim, to drop mist and water into the gaping abyss, the primordial yawning void, Ginnungagap. The Vala was there at the beginning of times, and she spoke. On all sides I saw the Valkyries assemble, ready to ride to the ranks of the gods. Skuld bore the shield, and Skogul rode next to her. Guth, Hild, and Gondul, the Valkyries are ready to ride over the earth. I saw Baldur, the bleeding god, the son of Odin. His destiny was set, famous and fair in the lofty fields, full grown in strength, with a mistletoe stood. You have been listening to Aristogenesis, presented to you by NordiskRadio.se.